Hello and welcome to episode 33 of season 3. That's a bit confusing. Actually, episode number 1 of season 3, but episode 33 in overall.
Yeah.
We have been out of air for now almost 2 weeks, Sharad. How does it feel? Are you missing this entire thing that we do?
Yeah, there was a big void in my usual Thursdays.
Right.
Two voids. One was actually speaking and the other one listening to myself speak in the night.
True. I hope our listeners have some similar feelings.
Yeah.
We obviously are not going to take that feedback on now.
I'm sure they remember that we were head-to-head with Game of Thrones, so that's why we decided to take a temporary break.
Yes, during our final episode of Season 2, the traffic numbers on Game of Thrones did go down a lot because everybody was tuned into long shots,
yeah,
as per unofficial stats. So, with all that behind us, a friendly reminder to all our listeners that long shots streams on an eclectic mix of apps, be it Google Podcast, Deezer, Apple iTunes. So do subscribe to our channel and do like it so that you get that nice little notification every time an episode goes live. So as you know, we had given a bit of a, I won't say a spoiler, but a bit of a hint in our last episode in season 2 that season 3 is going to be slightly different.
So do you want to explain why now?
Yeah, so in season 3, our listeners will have the benefit of hearing another person in addition to both of us.
A third voice.
A third voice, yes. We have now kicked off a guest series, if for the lack of a better word. And my first guest, I'm very happy to say, is a very dear and close friend of mine, Anuj Dayal. He is my batchmate from IIT Kharagpur, practically I think the second or third person I met on campus. But besides from being a dear friend, I think Anuj is especially qualified to be on this podcast because he's, I think, equally fascinated by business, finance and markets as both of us. Anuj worked in the UK for close to 5 years in Deutsche Bank, Oxif, HPS, looking at both structured credit as well as private equity. He was obviously in IIT Kharagpur, then went to IIM Ahmedabad. Anuj, welcome. How's it going?
Lovely to be here, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's so you're a private equity person. Obviously, Nikhil knows you very well. No, I don't, nor do our listeners. So how was what brings you to India, and how much do you miss private equity core, or do you think there's a lot of private equity play in India as well?
I think I basically moved back for the pollution. Right.
Yes.
I'm just completely missing it in London. Yeah. So I decided to move back for that reason. It's obviously having the desired results already. And I'm sure your listeners will hear me coughing throughout the podcast as well.
And you know, like, it's not really fun, like, when you open the weather app and you have, like, clear skies. It's always better to have that, you know, unhealthy haze on it. Kind of makes it exciting.
Makes it more akin to a Game of Thrones episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. That's like the most encouraging coming back to home story I've heard of. And Anuj, like, in terms of obviously, let's start with startups, okay?
Right.
Because I know that you are obviously looking at startup valuations almost at an obsessive level. You are kind of trying to find, you know, where the story works, where it doesn't work. But before you kind of, you know, give us your thoughts, you know, I was reading, I think, a couple of days back, Economist actually did a recent cover on tech unicorns in the US. It was saying that while, you know, it's interesting because all of them are kind of following this strategy of blitz scaling, right? And the biggest testament to that is, like, while Amazon, which is considered to be the pioneer of blitz scaling, spent like close to $3 billion between 1995 and 2002, Uber spent $4 billion of burn only in 1 year. That was last year. So I think in that kind of a, you know, irrepressive cash burn, discounts first, cash back first strategy is something which has also affected Indian startup ecosystem. So, I mean, what are your thoughts there?
So, I mean, Uber is an interesting example, right? Because when we were at Oxif, that was one of the sort of deals that we looked at. This was obviously back in the day, about 5 years ago.
Right.
The valuation at that point was, relative to now, a much more decent number, I would say, around,
yeah,
22, 25 billion.
Yeah, now it's IPOing at 90 billion. That's what the number is, yeah.
That's right. So, I mean, obviously, people who put in money there have made a bunch of money, including obviously guys like SoftBank and, you know, Rajiv Mishra and the guys. Even at that point, I mean, I've always sort of had a fundamental issue with Uber's business model. Now, I agree, what they've done is stupendous, right? For a customer, the ability to get a cab or a car at the push of a button, fairly reliable service, I would say. Excellent drivers, especially when you move back to sort of the Indian context, you realize how much the quality has improved. So there's definite things that are doing much better than any company before. But if you just talk about the business model, right? I mean, effectively what is done is push the costs of car maintenance, push the costs of car driving, the time that is required, onto the driver. At some point, the driver doesn't realize what their effective unit economic costs are. If you think about like a centralized model of car ownership, which is a model that was followed in India as well, Mabel Cabs used to follow it.
Yeah.
In the UK, there was Addison Lee. You remember using it back in the day.
Right.
The other thing you'd remember there in those models is all of them used to have exactly the same model of car, right? Addison Lee was always the same model. Then not the new executive version, which is different, but otherwise they had the same Ford Galaxy. Same for Meru, pretty much the same exact model. A similar model that was being followed by Southwest, right? One of the pioneers of low-cost air travel.
Yeah.
All of the planes they have is the same Boeing models. Helps in basically keeping the cost of maintenance low because you have a central workshop.
Correct.
Works out every day. Yeah.
But Anush, here's what worries me. I was going through their S1 filings, and I think one of the lines was, they don't expect ever to make money. I mean, that's not what they wrote, but they said that we don't know when we'll ever make money.
Right.
And that is sort of interesting. And I'm completely in agreement with what you're saying and your views on Uber. But that sort of, you know, Nikhil and I in previous episodes have sort of talked about how there are so many startups which are probably not making money. Their unit economics are challenging. And like he said, it's about discounting and chasing growth at all costs. And do you think Uber is setting a template just because it's, and listen, this IPO, it's making the same kind of noise that Facebook made in terms of 100 billion big tech IPO coming up, like people have been waiting for it, right? Is it setting a template that, you know what, you don't need to be profitable. You will still get, like, you know what, profitable, which was the underlying core of business, right? Profitability, profit margins. These guys are sort of saying, like, we don't even know whether we'll be profitable. It's a leap of faith, right? Do you think it sets a sort of dangerous template, and how do you think that flows into the Indian ecosystem? Because there are hardly any profitable unicorns in the Indian ecosystem, and you obviously understand that space even from the fintech standpoint, but is that something that bothers you, or what do you think about that?
I mean, I think the interesting thing there is obviously, like, personally I would not invest at the valuation they are at right now.
Yeah.
Probably even at a much lower valuation, I would not be a buyer. And to be honest, like, I haven't done the numbers. This is just purely talking about.
Yeah, which is fine. Yeah.
The business model is not something I understand, right? The issue from a fund manager perspective, right? Like, most of the money that's going to come in here is going to be institutional.
Yeah.
And so far, it's institutional. So I don't think we need to talk about, like, retail people burning their fingers. That's probably going to happen, but fair. Right?
Yeah.
Like, buy everywhere. I think the bigger issue is you look at a fund manager who's sitting there right now, kind of like in the same position that I was in, when I said, actually, at 25 billion, I don't think Uber's. And by the way, we were not putting in a huge amount of money, but whatever the small amount was, I did not do that, right? If I was still employed by that company, when this company, when Uber's valued at 90 billion, at some point my MD is going to make a wise crack and say, you know, let go of a 4x trade.
Yeah.
What happens to, if you look at the psychology of that trader, who did not put in money into this private valuation round 4 years ago, or for some other similar company, even if it's not money making, and then they end up IPOing at some value. How does he think about it now, right? Does he think, actually, I've been wrong for 7 years, but now I'm going to be right? Probably not.
Yeah.
Even I feel like an idiot, right? If making money was the only objective, which probably it is,
yeah,
then I look like an idiot at this point.
There are two sides of it, right? One is you can like look at it as a hot hand syndrome or something, that, you know, you're right once, you feel that, you know, you're right not because of a chance or because of the cycle that you're invested in, but you're right because your idea itself had a lot of fundamental merit. And obviously fund managers, anyone who actually invests, if he gets a good money on money multiple, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy for him that, look, I told you so. But, like, let's kind of, if we kind of step back from it and look at it as a standalone business, right? Look at it. I mean, and why just Uber, you know? If you look at, I mean, for me, the biggest point of struggle here is that, you know, we kind of keep on hearing of, like, a network effect, that, you know, the network is more important than the individual customer, and it's the value that's created by the network. Obviously, Facebook made a killing by that model. Google made a killing by that model. Even Amazon, to a certain extent, made a killing on that model. But those companies, let's face it, were able to create some sort of a protective moat around them. Like, there is some sort of a switching cost if you switch off Facebook tomorrow. But there is practically zero switching cost if I want to move from an Uber to an Ola, or from a Swiggy to a Zomato, right? Is that why like things don't often work? Or I mean, is that why we get so nervous about looking at their business models? Because we know as customers ourselves that, like, for instance, if tomorrow, like, I want to, you know, I don't know, order food, like whichever has the better selection of restaurants or a better deal coupon, I just go with that service. I really don't care about, you know, the brand, or I don't have any customer loyalty. This customer loyalty is something that they need to work on.
So I guess, I mean, if I was to ask the question in a slightly different way, you're saying, are all markets by nature winner takes all, right? I mean, Facebook probably is. Social media networking space between friends. If you know you are on a network that no one else is on, obviously the network is useless, right? So you might as well be on Facebook. Your point is Uber is something that might not be a winner takes all market.
The thing is that Facebook at the end of the day is not a commoditized offering. Every person's Facebook experience is different. It's kind of customized to that person's connections. So it is a unique experience for everyone. Like your Facebook feed will look pretty different from my Facebook feed, right? But your experience in a taxi won't be very different from my experience in a taxi, correct? So, I mean, effectively the network is something which gives differentiation to Facebook. That's why it is well positioned to be a monopoly.
Right.
But if you look at an Uber or a Swiggy or a Zomato or, you know, any of these, Ola or whatever, they are in spaces where at the end of the day, the customer proposition that they are providing is a commodity. It is very standardized. It can be replicated by anyone else who has that kind of capital. And hence, it kind of leads to a, you know, cycle where you will never have a winner-take-all market. You would have one or two main players, and you have a lot of small, you know, sub-verticals of specialist players, you know, there might be some Uber for airports. You know, there might be some Uber for, you know, last-mile connectivity. I mean, we're already seeing that, like, especially in a country like India, where, you know, you don't have last mile connectivity when it comes to public transport. A lot of aggregators are just focusing on the last mile connectivity portion, you know. So, I mean, is that a way to kind of look at this?
That's interesting in the point that you made, I think, about niches, right? Sometimes you forget that niches themselves combine can be a fairly big business as well.
Sure.
And then people can effectively play those niches much better than Uber can. So, I forget the name of the company, but there's a company in the UK that, or actually I should say London itself, just the metropolitan area in London, that does an Uber, but only for disabled people, right?
Okay.
I'm not sure what the political correct term now is, but effectively that, right? It's basically a market that requires a bigger taxi than the likes of what Uber usually provide. It requires a cab that can, you know, have a bigger door to get a wheelchair in,
sure,
and stuff like that. And that's actually a very profitable. The last time I looked at them, I think they were within like a year or so, and less than 500 cab, they were doing like 2 million bottom line, 2 million pounds.
So they're already more profitable than Uber.
So is that a viable way in the sense that to identify those pockets and kind of, you know, have a, I mean, like the thing is, like, let's face it, I mean, in spite of whatever we discuss here, companies like, you know, like companies which have already had so much invested capital in them, they're not going to disappear tomorrow, right? I mean, effectively, there will be a lot of viability gap funding, for the lack of a better word, which you see in public sector, in private sector, right? Just to make them running, and there's going to be a stage when someone is going to get a good exit, that will become a nice story. That's what happened with Flipkart as well, right? Flipkart at the end of its cycle, the founders got a funky exit, all the Indian papers were like, oh my god, this is such a beautiful story, they got 6,000 crores each. So, I mean, I think that kind of, I mean, these guys have already had some sort of first mover's advantage, so they are kind of...
From flipping the investment and monetizing the investment, I think we're all fairly convinced that model works. We've seen everyone profitable exit is just upward sloping, and even in the Indian landscape, right? But it's the long-term sustainability of business that is more interesting to look at or predict or call out for.
The other thing, and you know, given that I'm looking to be an entrepreneur myself, like this is something I grapple with on a daily basis. I'm
yeah.
sure you guys as well. But one of the things this has done, is actually markedly increase the risk to be an entrepreneur. I'll elaborate on why I think that is the case. A few, maybe decades ago, probably, right? Like when we were probably not even around or definitely not thinking about business. Profitable business used to be one which would be, require some legwork, maybe 6-7 months. People, you know, used to start off and it was making money on day one.
Yeah.
Because it exploited some, Reliance, right?
Yeah.
For instance, it was making money on day one. Whatever we might think about the business when it started off, it had fairly sound fundamentals, definitely also political connections, but fairly sound fundamentals. And it was a business that was doing well. So what happens then is that the entrepreneur is actually getting or taking money out of the business legally, properly, taking money out of the business on a monthly, yearly basis. He doesn't have to wait for that one IPO that's going to happen once in his life after 10 years of work.
Sure.
How much are Indian entrepreneurs, and you mentioned Zomato, right? Like, we've discussed this before. I think his salary details are also public. How much has he made on an annual basis? Definitely more than the average sort of average medium worker in India, but how much money has he actually made? Now, he's, for his entire wealth, he's reliant on this one IPO. Compare that to a guy who's, I mean, obviously he's going to make a bunch of money, right? And when he retires, obviously dilution, etc. aside, and he doesn't own that much of Zomato anymore, but when it lists, he's still in for a good payday. Same as the Bansal, right?
Yep.
They both own, I don't know, 1/16 of the company at that point. Smallish numbers compared to what Jeff Bezos owned, but still.
Sure, yeah.
A billion each, right?
That, I mean, that's serious money,
yeah.
Right? In cash.
Yeah.
Probably very serious money.
Right.
But the issue is, how many entrepreneurs does that really happen to? Now, you've created, because of this sort of VC funding climate, you've created entrepreneurs who essentially want to burn, draw salaries of like 15, 20 lakhs, where they could definitely get paid a lot more,
yeah,
in a proper job, and keep waiting for that exit to happen, which frankly is not going to happen for most of us. It's not going to happen for most entrepreneurs. Like, how many IPOs do you know? Or how many exits do you know? Like,
IPO cycles have already kind of gone up from like an average of 6 to 7 years to 10 years, and that's in the US, right? In India, I think the IPO cycle is even longer.
Longer, yeah.
But I mean, the interesting point here is that obviously, I mean, I think, you know, obviously the inflow of VC money does have that effect. But come to think of it, with the reason why a few decades back, most entrepreneurs were not following that model was that most businesses had to be capital intensive on day one and had to be cash generative on day one as well, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's technology, it's like cloud storage, it's platform synergies, which actually, you know, helps people with very minimal money to start. Like, for instance, like we are in the news curation business, right? So we have, with fairly limited investment, managed to become a quote-unquote publisher, right? We don't have any printing presses. We don't have any kind of offline distribution, right? So I think that access to, or that with tech, since the barriers to entry have gone down, right? The endpoint has also gone back. Don't you think that kind of goes, I mean, I'm not kind of getting into it, whether it was a tech which incentivized the VCs or the VCs who are incentivizing the tech. Probably it's the first situation rather than the second situation. But I mean, that generally has some sort of a, you know, effect on the overall cycle of the business as well. Like, I mean, like, if, like, even like, don't you feel that when you tell someone from, not from maybe from our generation, but if you ask, if you talk to someone who's like, you know, two or three generations above you, when you tell them, oh, what are you doing? I'm going to start a business. And like, okay, if you don't come from a business family, right? I mean, where do you have the initial wealth? Because they feel that business is like, oh, you have to set up a plant or set up a unit. Right, they still are in that world.
Manufacturing,
right?
Mindset.
They have the manufacturing mindset. Right?
Unit economics on day one mindset. Cash burn appetite of zero mindset. Like, those are the things that the traditional businesses had.
And you know, I think those early tech success stories, which are kind of literally vouched by everyone, be it a Google or a Facebook or an Amazon, let's face it, or a Netflix, they did have a true first mover's advantage. You know, I mean, I don't think a Swiggy or an Uber had a first mover's advantage.
But let me ask you a question this way, guys. Like, you're saying, you know, business models have fundamentally changed because of the low barriers to entry.
Correct.
That's kind of the summary, right? Business, like, there are lower barriers to entry. That gives us sort of two main points to think about. One is, even when you're a very big guy, like an Ola or Uber, does your competition effectively have the same availability of a low barrier to entry? In the case of Facebook, definitely the barriers to entry are very high, right? And with increased regulation, which Facebook itself supports,
sure.
So that is only going to go up. What about a localized taxi operator which only caters to, you know, sectors 60 to 50 in Noida? Like, is that a viable business model which still has a low barrier to entry? That's the sort of stuff that is essentially the question, right? That going forward, can they play or operate more effectively than large sort of network?
Right. Like, it's sort of moving from scale to margin, right? Like on one end you have scale and you're not seeing margins, or you're seeing loss-making firms. Let's call it the unicorns, most of them, at least anyway. And on the other end, you're saying these niche pockets, like you give the example of the service, the UK cab service, which catered to a special demographic, right? And you're, let's say a local cab service, you're saying about sectors X to Y in Noida. So you're moving from scale to limited sort of scale, but you're trading that off with premium margin positioning, correct? Like premium. That sort of niche play, are you talking about? Like when you say pocket, like find pockets of, within a larger aggregated network, find pockets where you can capitalize and become really good at it and trade that off with margins?
Or maybe you can do that because you have significantly lower costs than Uber does, right? As I said, like in an Uber model, because the cost that at some point someone has to bear in the system.
Sure, yeah.
There's no benefit of centralization of sort of the main costs, which are the costs of car maintenance, fuel, and stuff like that, right? Like how do you, can someone like Amdeo possibly do a much better job if they were very concentrated? Again, this is not to talk about taxi services, just in
yeah, yeah.
I'm saying for so the barrier to entry point was basically that, right? That does, are low barriers to entry also low barriers to entry to your competition once you become someone of decent enough scale? And if that is the case, right, then these businesses, firstly, like, I don't know what multiples they trade on because they don't have any EBITDA to talk about. But like, when they do have an EBITDA, like, their multiples should be significantly lower because they are technically businesses that are more prone to disruption than a sort of a manufacturing setup like a petroleum refinery in Jamnagar, right? So should that have a much higher EBITDA multiple versus these, then they have an EBITDA?
I think there's a scarcity value problem there, right? I mean, like, it's the same thing. Like, for instance, if you ask me as an individual investor, right, that, okay, would I like to invest in a aggregator specific to old age homes or retirement homes, you know, which is very profitable, but which has its own, you know, kind of niche place. I mean, it will grow, but it will never grow very, very aggressively, but it will always make good money. As an individual, probably that's a good investment for me. But if, as soon as I get into a fund structure, right, there is that internal mandate that I have, which kind of, I mean, and it's a philosophical mandate to some extent, over scale. I think it's a half mandate. It obviously does not always reflect the entire thing, but I think a lot of VCs think of it like that. So if suppose I pitch that retirement home opportunity to a VC, they might feel, you know, I mean, I think that why, and that's the reason why the Uber, which probably is more prone to disruption, which probably is more prone to competition because of the technological nature of its business, still trades at a higher multiple. I mean, because from a supply perspective, naturally is more better positioned for me. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, in the same Economist article that I was referring to, they interestingly picked up, I think, 20 unicorns worldwide, and they obviously had the main, you know, the usual suspects, Uber, WeWork,
yeah,
and so on. And they looked at, I mean, I think, and currently all of them are, out of the 12 are up for IPOs. And I mean, the IPO expectation collaboratively is around $250 billion, you know, in terms of the actual amount, right? Which is equal to the amount which Alphabet, Facebook, and Alibaba raised, right, collectively. Mm-hmm. And the Economist guys, I mean, I don't know about the assumptions, but they did a DCF, right? They did a DCF and they saw, okay, what is the sales and margin growth these businesses need to generate over the next 10 years to justify a $250 billion valuation? Sales growth was around 40%, margin growth was around 35%.
Right.
Facebook managed to have their sales growth in the last 8 to 10 years, but their margin growth was still 19%. Facebook.
Yeah.
Right. So clearly there is a distortion there, right?
And see, just on Facebook, I think that margin is probably going to go lower. Like, all of you would have seen the FTC fine.
Correct.
It's going the same way as banks went after 2007, right? They were the poster child, and then...
I mean, and Facebook had the benefit of entering a world where the regulatory framework around a tech platform was not even there, right? And now that platform is coming back with a vengeance, right? So...
It will happen. I mean, I would encourage you guys and like all your listeners to read Raghuram Rajan's latest book, right? The Third Pillar.
Okay.
It talks about how like tech's probably taking over a huge part of the role that sort of community used to play.
Right.
And in that, it's effectively disenfranchising the community.
Right.
Which I to some extent agree with, right? Like
right.
Tech is to a large extent changing our views without us necessarily knowing about it. But yeah, that's a separate topic. To come back on the point about what you made on VC funding and how that's probably led, I mean, if there's a lot of funding that is changing scale,
right,
effectively all entrepreneurs who want some money have to go and talk about scale and passion about
money.
And that's a circular logic, right? I mean, that's a circularity that everyone falls into. Like, you chase scale or you don't sort of raise.
I mean, like, these are not useless things when I'm pitching to a VC, like, just for this.
Yeah.
Of course not.
So, I mean, scale and if all of the businesses are effectively sort of end up chasing that, then you always have businesses, as you said, that will end up chasing scale. But look back 10 years, and you know, I think the market, example of DMart in my mind is a very sort of strong and interesting example for that, from that perspective. Like, I know it was funded by a hugely wealthy guy who was less wealthy now than he then, but still, you know, he was a fairly wealthy guy. And did all of the things that, you know, we were just attributing to sort of older generation mindset.
Right. Like, yeah.
What are unit economics? Does your thing make money on day one? How are you going to raise the capital? These were issues they solved over time, and, you know, phenomenally good operations. The brand is fairly strong. None of us has probably gone to a DMart, but, you know, the sort of clientele they cater to has good respect for. You know what I mean, right?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
That business has done well. And if you look at DMart today, you only know about it because it IPO'd. Before that, you're like, oh, what is this interesting store, right? Somewhere in Panvel, I've never seen this before. But
Cater to a niche, like you said.
They did a phenomenal job. Trading at an exceptionally good multiple right now, which again, you can argue with it, but wasn't VC funded.
Right.
And I think if I was to put my money on a bet, right? I don't know how to invest into it, but if I was to take a bet, I would say in 5 or 10 years from now, you would see a non-VC funded, money-making, IPO, profitable business
that
people are investing in today,
and
which is not being done by a VC.
Right.
And, I mean, the other issue that comes with, I think, investing with scale is that you have VCs making atrocious claims like this product is going to touch 500 million users, right? I mean, I was showing you this product earlier in the morning. It's called DoubtNut. I mean, no disrespect, obviously, to the formers. I think to the founders, they're trying to solve, you know, a good problem. How do you ask a question which has differential equations in it?
It's called DoubtNut, is it?
DoubtNut, that's right, DoubtNut. I know for sure it was part of the Sequoia Surge platform.
Yeah.
That's sort of meant to cater to early stage companies. It's a 3-year-old company, or roughly around 3-year-old company. Essentially, you take a photo of a mathematics problem that you have, upload it onto their website or their app, which is Android, I think, or iOS. And, you know, they show you a video explaining the solution. That's the intent.
To that specific problem, or like a general solution?
So obviously...
No, I mean, like, what is it supposed to say? I'm sorry.
To that specific problem.
Oh, okay.
Obviously, that's an intent. I don't think it's working. As we sort of found out today, we asked a question about, like, you know...
And a tough mandate as well.
It's a tough mandate.
Yeah.
Definitely it's a tough mandate, but that's what they're trying to solve. And I see the value in that, right? Like, when we were back in school, if you wanted to Google something like this, like, just putting in the differential equation is a pain. How do you do it, right? So yes, the idea is interesting. What they want to do, and, you know, all power to them, hopefully they solve that issue at some point. Like, you know, it's a good idea. But I read one of their investors, I don't remember the name, younger, she was basically saying, you know, I think this is going to touch 500 million users in the next 6 years.
Right.
Why is that even important? Like, I mean, I don't understand.
I think that's like, I mean, actually,
it's not gonna happen. But why is it?
You know, like, that's the self-fulfilling prophecy thing that I think me and Sharad, we spoke about that in a lot of episodes. You know, because like, we keep on hearing of the 300 to 400 million great Indian middle class, every founder and every VC is trying to aim for. Correct.
Sure.
And then one fine day they all realize that, you know, to be qualified to be a middle class, you need to make at least $10 a day, right? I mean, that is what, $300 a month. Not a lot of Indian families actually making that money, and the actual number of middle class is not more than 70 million. But 70 million is a poor story. 300, 400 million is a good story. It ties with what China's middle class is, and I think that's it. No one is thinking more than that, you know.
Yeah.
And if suppose the girl would have said that I'm going to, you know, target the next 1 million Indians, probably it won't be, you know, probably her VC overlords are going to get a bit disappointed. Yeah. Come on, like we backed you with, I don't know, 20, 30 crores or whatever number they have.
And the thing is like simple equation, right? Like revenue potential is just price times quantity, right? So people just want to upsell quantity side of the equation.
Right.
They know that price is hard sell, right? It gets capped after, you can't infinitely raise price. But quantity is an easier sell. So with that framework, I think intuitively people just say like, you know, my Q is, or quantity is going to just go up exponentially, and hence direct correlation with revenue. So that goes up. That's sort of the mindset I think people are looking at. And that is disruptive. Like, I mean, there are challenges with it, right? I mean, there's no pricing power. There is, like, which Nikhil was saying, like, there's, the competition is so homogeneous. Like, I honestly don't know whether I can choose between Zomato and
I think that happens
Uber.
When you don't have a senior MD breathing down your neck, telling them that, okay, it's okay to reverse engineer a number,
yeah,
but you need to have some, you know, basis behind
logic,
it.
Logic, so yeah. No, yeah. So, but no, that's pretty interesting. So, fintech is a space that you particularly like, correct?
Fintech is a space, I don't say like, it just...
Or closely follow.
Yes, yes, I definitely do. Especially fintech in the lending domain. So, and that just goes back to my background, right? Like, and for the benefit of the listeners, last 2 years, I was working for a fund called the European Asset Value Fund. Essentially, what we would do is invest into NBFC columns. They're called something else, but
mm-hmm.
they do the same sort of work,
right,
in Europe and UK. Effectively, you know, there was this NBFC that we bought, which, you know, is in the process of now becoming a bank, that effectively lends to SMEs, right? MSMEs, I would say,
okay,
in 17 other countries, including Russia. Mostly, most other countries are European, and Russia obviously is the outlier there. And then used to own, so that's the MSME side of things, which is, I understand, increasingly popular in the fintech space here. And then we obviously used to do consumer lending as well in the Nordics and in the UK. And that's also fairly popular. A lot of money has flown into this sector in India. It just, you know, I don't really have specific numbers to point to, but I can point to sort of anecdotes where I feel this is so reminiscent of stuff that my bosses used to tell me used to happen in 2004 and 2006 in the US, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, I'll give you an example. Like, massively well-funded company, I'm not going to name it because, you know, we spoke in more sort of confidence.
Sure.
But essentially does sort of car bike sharing, sort of, it's a car bike sharing platform.
Okay.
Which, you know, there's a bunch of them out there. Raised a lot of money. And this guy is asking me, listen, I'm going to set up this NBFC. Effectively, there are people who come onto my platform who want to borrow my car for a day, don't have the cash,
right,
so I want to lend to them.
Okay.
And then pay me over time. Now, this is a business that's actually going to be a smaller ticket, more difficult to manage business than even payday lending. Right? And then I used to sort of manage a payday lender and its transition from a payday lender into a near prime lender, right, which is more compatible with most regulators, and it's an incredibly difficult business, right?
So just for the benefit, like, payday lender is linked to your it's basically a cyclical lending.
It's a cyclical lending platform. Essentially, what it does is, you know, you get paid every 31st, let's say, or the
right.
first, and now on the 20th, have no money left. Something
right.
all of us are not familiar with. But at the point where I'm
sure.
No, this is going around with the elitist.
Yes, I know.
We saw that, we got that, yeah.
So, I mean,
no, nobody's going to fund us, bro. I mean, everybody's going to be like, okay, you obviously don't go to DMART, and you obviously, you know, talk of payday lending with such disdain. So,
I will talk of
payday. Yeah, sure, yeah.
I mean, it's not a customer, I think. Unfortunately, people who are listening to you who have iPhones, for instance,
right.
like you mentioned Apple, whatever,
right.
they don't have this issue.
Right.
They don't have this issue.
Right.
Payday is predatory, let's just put it that way.
It is predatory.
Yeah.
Right? And if they have this issue, I mean, there's something more fundamentally wrong with them.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's not a huge market problem here.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the US and the UK, it's a massive issue, right?
Yeah.
It's also, I mean, how you can pick up whether the market is going the same way or not is by seeing how many gold advertisements you see for gold lending.
Right.
Right.
True.
And that's becoming an increasingly popular market here. Like, it's a disorganized market. I think a friend of mine who runs a startup called Rupeek is looking to sort of organize that and bring it under like an aggregator sort of approach. But you're seeing interest in that market. So there are definitely the stress. There is a credit stress population that can't get loans anywhere else. Goes out and pawns its family gold or whatever else, or iPhones, right? And gets money against that. It's a... instinctively you think about that market and you're like, okay, this guy is in serious trouble.
Yeah.
I think your instinct is right in this case, right?
Yeah.
That is the reason why he's coming to a payday like that.
Correct.
So it's a very hard business, I mean, for a variety of reasons. One is obviously your customer has poor credit to start off with. His family economics are bad, which is why he's come to you and he's borrowing from you at like 500-600% APR in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, like, you obviously are not going to get any support from the regulator ever. Unless you're paying him off, which is different, can happen, but you're never going to get support from a regulator. You're never going to get support from a civil society, right? Like, maybe some guys there, but largely speaking,
yeah,
that's why it becomes such a hard business to do, right? And all those have costs,
right?
And now, what this guy is trying to do, the guy I was talking about, the car sharing platform guy, is on the riskier end of even that. He's saying this guy needs a service,
mm-hmm.
which is probably ideally should be like, I don't know, 1/100 of his monthly income,
right?
Which is why he needs to borrow a car like for a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sort of
yeah.
percentage of his monthly salary that this should be, right, in your mind. Maybe, I don't know, 20th. And you're lending that to him. You're not even lending him a month's salary. You're lending him a 20th of his salary.
Correct.
That's so much riskier than a payday loan.
Right.
And I just, you know, I looked at, I was talking to this guy.
But that's risky anywhere, right? That is, I think, irrespective to do with, even if the regulator cares, or regulator kind of tries to make sure that, you know, some sort of a risk management framework is there. It's risky anyway, right? If you're looking at like such a short-tailed ticket size.
And I mean, I can give you sort of hard facts for why that is risky.
Yeah.
If you're lending 50,000 bucks rupees, right, to a borrower, you can send someone to his house, to his shop, legally, extra-legally, whatever, to get the money back.
Collections. Is the issue. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a cost for collection, right?
Yeah.
You need to
have a guy who does that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need like 5 heavy looking guys. I mean, no, one guy is not probably going to cut it, right?
Right.
Like, you need like these 5 heavy looking dudes who show up and are like, I'm going to take your car if you want to pay us. So
right.
That sort of stuff. That has a cost. You need to find out where this dude lives.
Right.
He might have moved.
Right.
Maybe he did such a bad job of giving him a room. He never knew where he lived.
Correct.
So there's a cost to that collection, right?
Right.
All of us have tried to do this with friends who we give them money, not send 5 dudes, but try to get money back out of them. And you know how intensive that is, even with friends. Forget people you do not have.
Sure.
Now you're giving someone a loan to effectively borrow your car for a day or an hour or whatever, and that's maybe like $1,000. I don't know. There's the cost of collection is way more than
yeah.
the loan you're giving out.
Right.
And that's why it's so risky, because there's no incentive to.
But I mean, isn't like obviously we were looking at I think it was yesterday or 2 days back when we were looking at credit growth numbers in India, like overall, and I mean consumer credit is fairly sluggish at the moment, right? I hear on the auto side, you know, the credit card side, we're on the personal loan side, right? So I mean, obviously there's a need there, right? I mean obviously there's a slowdown of demand as well. I mean,
sure.
We can kind of, and there's also a lot of discussion on whether more credit in like autos or personal loan actually leads to more spending. I mean, that let's leave all those philosophical discussions aside. But if you look at today in the space of consumer lending, obviously looking at a short day, one day car service loan or whatever is, yeah, I get it. But what is the vertical you think might be an attractive vertical from a lending perspective?
So I think macro, it makes a lot of sense that India is credit starved. There is no doubt in my mind about that.
Right.
We all know moneylender families that have done increasingly that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In this country, right? That's been a business since I don't know forever. Interesting thing. I will probably talk about it. Interesting story that I want to share if we have the time. But I think the consumer story, as consumer being stressed, is definitely interesting. The issue is, I think so many people are going after giving, especially in the fintech space, and that is why I refer to anecdotes, I don't have numbers, right? Are going after lending which is inherently easy. And what do I mean by that? Like lending that is supposed to allow you greater amounts of consumption is inherently easier to do than lending that creates value. Right? So
yeah.
There's that difference. When you lend to an SME, to working capital, or you lend to an SME to buy a machine, unless the management is bad or they're investing in something which is stupid, it creates more value for that company.
Correct.
You can argue about larger impacts on the society, etc., etc., but generally it will create more value. So he can use that money to repay you. What does a person gain by financing an iPhone? Right? I guess that's the question. Like, if someone that can't afford an iPhone but should rather buy a Micromax and then ends up buying an iPhone or an EMI, how does that create more value for him?
So there's no economic value added, so therefore it's riskier. Is that what he's saying? So in your sort of riskier,
it's easier.
It's easier as well, and I think that's where most people are therefore going.
Yeah.
And by that definition, it then ends up becoming riskier because, you know.
So, like, do you see that as a, like, for instance, like, if you look at American Express,
yeah,
right, they provide you iPhone EMIs,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Any big bank would have iPhone EMIs. So, do you think, like, that kind of easy, risky lending is something which should come later in your cycle and not as idea number one?
If you're talking about a credit-starved society,
right,
the thing that you first go ahead and do is try and solve those issues where people genuinely deserve and need the money and the businesses itself can, you know, generate enough money to return sort of the additional interest cost that you're creating for that family.
Right.
A good example of that, obviously, is you know, theoretically, is education. Right?
Yeah.
Ideally, it should create
income generation over time, right?
It creates income. It doesn't happen in our country because education quality and stuff like that, but typically that is the
narrative. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in your sort of car mini rental for a couple of hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
Offering credit for that. Let's say the guy borrows a car for 5 hours and uses it to drive on an Uber, let's say.
That makes sense all of a sudden, right?
That
does make sense. The only issue there is, you know, why do it for a 5 hour rental?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there is a very interesting company called Away Finance, set up by, I think, the guy who runs Ola, Abhish Agarwal,
his
that's what they are trying to do. For some reason, and I'm not very clued into this, like, Uber tried exactly a similar model in the US. It did not really work out, and they ended up selling it. I can get back.
Is that the financing arm of Uber?
Yes,
yeah,
yes,
they've
yes. Didn't really work out. I'm not sure why, but you know, maybe that was because the underwriting was made subservient to the need of Uber to grow.
Right.
If credit underwriting is good there, I think it actually is a good business, right?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be moralistic here. I'm not trying to say only lend to people who use it to create more money. That's not the intention, right? And I'm saying purely as a lender, what makes more sense, right? How do you get more money out of this guy? Isn't it better if you're actually helping him create more money for himself and then you take a chunk of that rather than saying... This is a consumption thing, right? Effectively, like, why is that part? So, on the vertical point, like, there's one very interesting business, I think, which, you know, again, I'm not talking about valuation here. I don't know what valuation they raise, that, etc. But I think the business itself is fulfilling a real need, and that is why it actually is a good business. It's called Drip Capital,
right.
DRIP. Again, people I don't know, so I'm not, like, sort of pushing their name for any reason. But effectively, what they do is, you know, there's this cloth manufacturers in India who are producing stuff for the likes of Zara or, I don't know, Benetton, H&M, you know, those sort of chains. And a huge load of these sweatshops exist in Bangladesh as well.
Yeah.
So once you produce the item and it's on a ship on its way to the US or London or wherever to get sold, there's an H&M guy who's already come on board and checked the stuff that you've sent, right? Because shipping itself has a huge cost. So they do it in Chittagong or Dhaka, wherever itself. They do those checks in Bombay and then they're like, okay, this stuff is fine. Once it reaches the port in New York, plus another 90 days, and you pay you back. Now that's a typical like 120 day cycle.
Right.
Getting financing for that invoice is incredibly difficult in Bangladesh or India because A, it's US dollar denominated or pound denominated or whatever. And more importantly, it's credit risk against the country, against an entity that's based.
Yeah.
Now, all of us know international banks have been retrenching for quite some time, right? HSBC does international banking as well, but I mean, you used to work with them, you realize like how they've been retrenching from various different countries.
Yeah.
So that business has become less and less challenged from the big players, especially as they've moved back to their home countries. These guys have come in and they've said, you know what, actually it's US dollar denominated invoice. I'll get US dollar denominated funding, take some part of the FX risk in India because I'm going to pay this guy in
rupees.
But they just add that on to the APR that they are borrowing at. Now,
right.
Zara credit risk, I don't know what it is, but like it's probably, let's say, something short of 5%. Right?
Right.
And these guys are living at 20. Now, is 15 good enough for 4-month FX risk? I think
sure.
You can help.
Sure.
Out. Yeah. And it's a business that's actually solving a problem for these guys who can still borrow at 20% because their margins on this working capital that they can sort of create more growth with is so much higher.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's pretty interesting.
So, I mean, like, the key here is that, effectively, like, you know, it kind of comes back to that entire barrier to entry or moat point, right? I mean, this is what it kind of comes to it. Like, at the end of the day, it's easy to lend to someone who wants to, you know, buy a watch. But like the example that you just gave right now, there are a lot of moving pieces here which you need to link up. And that's why it becomes a value proposition in the first place. So, I mean, that's the way, you know, one can kind of, like, even when you're looking at business models, that's probably a good way to attract both VC and non-VC funding, so as to say. But, you know, in terms of, if you're looking at, you know, credit overall as a space, I keep on, you know, reading about, there are so many NBFCs which are coming up, right? Every second day, there is someone who's taking a license and kind of getting into the space, right? And, I mean, do you think there is some sort of a shift which is happening from, you know, the state-driven financing system to, you know, more individual lenders? Or do you think these guys eventually would just be one service provider for the big guys? I mean, I say that because, like, I've seen that firsthand in peer-to-peer, right? In P2P, initially, it was supposed to be, you know, like, they take some underwriting risk, they kind of expand the book themselves, they do the linkages and matching, right? But RBI went in, kind of, you know, literally tied their hands up, and they, most of them then ended up as being like some sort of an online loan origination platform for bigger banks, right? Obviously, they're all NBFCs, they're all licensed and all that, but many of them are just pure tech platforms, they don't really end up doing the lending themselves. So I have a very cynical view when I see that, because I sometimes feel that, you know, when you have a hero financing, right, you can't really expect a online auto loan product on the side of it. You know, they are going to kind of absorb, they just have to weigh too much firepower, right, and the regulators on their side. So do you see that to be the status quo, or do you actually see that, you know, there is some amount of, you know, decentralized lending which is going to happen in the future?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. I mean, all of us at some point have been customers of banks, right? Either to borrow or more usually you to lend our money via deposits, right? In our case.
Yeah, yes.
So, I think the interesting thing there is who do you, I mean, barriers to entry.
Yeah.
Coming back to that point, what really attracts a customer to a loan? I think that there's usually like two things, right? And the second thing, I think, is less important than the first one. The first one is, what is the cost at which I'm going to get this loan? The second one is convenience.
Right.
Convenience includes other things like speed, how much do I have to, you know, spend, how easy it is to get the loan, all of that good stuff. Now, most of us are overbanked, right? Every time, like, you probably get like 2 or 3 calls every day, every week maybe.
Sure.
Saying, get a new credit card for me, or, I mean, I'm sure the 140 number you don't even pick up, but if you were, you would know, like, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are selling you DFSI products.
Yeah.
They know you're good guys, good customers, you have iPhones. So, in that sense, it just becomes one of those things where the competition is going to drive down the cost to an absolute minimum. And
yeah.
Who can survive at that point? Someone whose own input costs, to take the analogy of like overall industries, is the cheapest. The own input cost is only cheapest if you are funded by deposits.
Right.
And that is the cheapest source of capital anywhere
sure.
in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, other than foundational money or whatever else, which can take negative IRR, but more than, you know, large groups of money, if you're thinking about, like, that's the cheapest cost of capital. This is why if banks want to get into a business, barring their ability to solve the convenience part of the equation, it can always be cheaper than anywhere else,
yeah.
if they can get into a business.
Yeah.
Now, what's happened interestingly is sometimes Basel II and Basel III regulations, which at some point are also copied in India, ensure that some businesses are very expensive for banks to do. So those niches will always do very well. Like, I mean, we met guys who run a very big NBFC here in India. Like, will they be able to do well? Yes, sure. Because there are some niches that banks will never cater to.
Right.
Development lending being one. That is one of the businesses he told us about. That's
right.
The sort of stuff Blackstone is, you know, very good and very big at in the UK and the US. So those niches will always continue to survive. But because there's some barrier to entry of a bank.
Right.
And then you can become like the first amongst equals in NPSC and create a good space for yourself. But
yeah.
Does that lead to a great sort of platform valuation? Probably not, right?
Right.
But again, there's no significant barrier to entry in that business that you can create. Bajaj is a great example of like what a good barrier to entry looks like, because they finance so much of their own business.
True.
Right? It's a captive audience. They're not going to allow anyone else to come in and do it, even if that car is cheaper. And because of that, they're also able to leverage cheaper cost of funding. They're able to leverage their own distribution
scale
networks.
Scale, yeah.
You know, that kind of helps.
Cool. I think time has flown, Sharad.
Yeah.
52 minutes.
This was, I don't think I've ever spoken about credit and lending and leverage and valuation so much. So it's a space
we don't need to grow. We have so much money.
So that was an interesting chat. And you obviously referenced to iPhones and use that as a proxy. I see like an iPhone and a BlackBerry that you very confidently put on the desk. So
right.
I'm guessing it signifies twice as elite.
No, actually, yeah. The BlackBerry is super cheap.
It's,
I would totally recommend it. It's only like
$30,000. Right.
Emphasis on only.
Good note to end this on. No, it was great fun having you here, Anuj. And I mean, in terms of fintech, I mean, what I found, I think it's kind of a mixed world out there. I mean, recently RBI came up with their guidance on regulatory sandboxes, and they have kind of excluded cryptocurrencies from it. So I think India also, like, the regulators trying to catch up. And obviously, founders are also trying to catch up. But yeah, some fundamentals in terms of, the lowest cost of funding, they will always be a factor. And yes, same on the note of, I think, startup valuations. There are obviously opportunities to crack and solve some value-added problem. But also, there's a lot of noise. So I think investors need to watch out for, and we don't have to worry about anything because we just don't do all these things. We just talk about them. And so that was a very good start to episode 33, season 3.
Yeah, the only...
I don't know if Game of Thrones is still going on, but they're going to be sweating a lot.
Yeah, the only downside is now that you've set a precedent and the bar has been set, so...
Yes.
Tough one to follow. No, it was.
I'd love to come back.
Sure.
Yeah, you have to then. You have to set it even higher the next time. Then.
Yeah. No, thanks. It was really awesome. So thanks for your time.
And yeah, do obviously, guys. Obviously, assuming you're still there listening to us, comment, give your feedback on this guest series. If there's anyone who likes to actually come on board as a guest, do ping us, and we'll be happy to take that through our stringent internal process, whatever that is. And Anuj, I do welcome you to obviously share this podcast in your own network. And that's about it. And with that, this is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.